In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
You got the Mighty Manfred with the coolest conversations throwback in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My interview with Dave Faulkner of the Hoodoo Gurus originally aired Friday, March the 10th, 2017. In it, we discuss his growing up in Perth, Australia, moving to Sydney and forming the band, their subsequent success, his friendship with the Fleshtones, Little Steven sitting in with them, and their album Purity of Essence, which featured our then coolest song in the world, Cracking Up. Let's lend an ear to some of it now, and then we'll hear from Dave Faulkner on your Coolest Conversations throwback presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Ever since this trouble world began, every woman and man trying to find some purpose in their lives, some way to survive. And I'm the same, I'm not ashamed.
Hey, this is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest today on our Coolest Conversations is Dave Faulkner of the Hoodoo Gurus. How are you, Dave?
How are you, Manfred?
Excellent. So happy to be speaking with you today.
I know. Well, it's a long way apart. I'm in Sydney and you're in Los Angeles. It's pretty incredible.
That's right. That's right. But now you are originally from Perth, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's about 3,000 miles from where I'm living now. So, yeah, it's quite a long way from anywhere, to be honest.
Well, I've looked at a map before, Australia, and I thought, wow, Perth is like the ass end of that country, away from everything. And yet, Perth has got it going on. I mean, the likes of Kim Salmon and Don Mariani, this great band, the Chevelles, are there. We play here in the Underground Garage. What was it like growing up in Perth?
Well, Perth was, as I say, it's a very island sort of place. It's separated by desert and ocean from anywhere else in the world, really. Yeah, so growing up in Perth was kind of weird, you know. I'm obviously, you know, a normal childhood, but when you got a bit older and you started listening to music and reading magazines, you started to kind of feel a bit hemmed in because a lot of the favourite artists that were touring Australia wouldn't make it across the desert to Perth. So we felt a bit, you know, forlorn over there and a bit isolated in our little cultural desert. So, you know, when the punk scene came along, you know, and I was like 18, or actually I was probably 17 when we discovered punk rock, you know, we all started reading the magazines and buying the records on import. And, you know, we all formed our own punk bands and started our own scene. And that was probably what gave birth to, you know, people like Kim Salmon and, you know, the Triffids and people like that. And you mentioned the Chevelles, that sort of inherited from that scene. But the punk scene was kind of the first thing that really was original music being played instead of, you know, cover versions. Or the blues scene as well was kind of pretty solid there. But, you know, we were sort of outside of all those people.
And that the first band of yours, was that the Victims?
It was the Victims, yes, indeed. Yeah, we made a single and an EP, and we only lasted for about, you know, 9 months, something like that. But we had a hell of a time doing it, and funnily enough, people still like those records. So they got, you know, something we never dreamed anyone would even hear them, let alone, you know, like them this far after the time. But, yeah, they got a good reputation, those songs.
Well, the Hoodoo Gurus, though, is not something that started in Perth, that you guys formed in Sydney.
Yeah, well, I traveled for a year, most of a year when I was about 21, and I spent about 8 months in the US. Most of that time was in New York City, and I saw the Cramps, and I saw the B-52s and all these different bands and all the underground scene. And it was just a really an incredible experience for me, having, as I say, been in this isolation of Perth to be in the big wide world. And and another band I saw was the Fleshtones, who, you know, became friends of ours and, you know, who I worship to this day. So that time was quite influential for me personally as well as musically, you know. So when I came back off that trip away and I had no money, ended up back in Perth again, my ambition was to get the hell out of Perth as soon as I could, because, you know, the music scene was based out of Sydney and Melbourne. It's just a fact of life, you know, especially back then you had to live in a big city like those two to get anywhere in the music industry and to, you know, have anyone, you know, because bands would come and go in Perth. You'd form, you get your followers, and then you'd sort of break up eventually because there was nowhere else to go, you know, and you would, no one would ever offer you gigs elsewhere. So it was kind of like a trap, really. So I wanted to get somewhere else where there's a few more opportunities and a bit more of a big scene to sort of plug into. And so I eventually moved to Sydney after, you know, being back in Perth for most of a year and paying back that debt. And that was when the Gurus formed in the early 81.
Well, not counting your hiatus years, I think the band was, you're together like 16 years and then, you know, stopped for a while. And since reforming around like 2003, that's like another 14 years. So together, that's 30 years. This would be your 30-year anniversary. Any celebrations?
No, we're still playing gigs. So as you say, you know, that's our celebration, you know, actually being standing up and on stage and still making a racket and having fun. You know, that's all the tribute we want to pay to ourselves is just do that well, you know.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, you had a gig in Melbourne, and you had one of these rock star types in the audience checking out. I think you put him to work. You know who I'm talking about here?
I do indeed. Yes, your boss.
Yes.
Little Stephen had a night off from doing the Springsteen tour, and to his credit, you know, I can't believe he did this. He actually, you know, on his night off, went and saw a rock and roll band play. We had a gig in a zoo at Melbourne, which is a sort of a strange thing. It was a twilight zoo because it's summer over here right now.
Right.
And, you know, we had an outdoor show. It was like the twilight. And little Stephen came along and he stood side stage and was, you know, came a little halfway through the first song, actually. So it was a bit of a sort of a daunting thing for me seeing him standing there with his bandana on and everything. And he actually got up with us on the encore and played. We played a version of Pushing Too Hard by The Seeds, which, of course, I'm sure is a bit of a favorite in your underground garage there.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So, and he was fantastic. You know, and we obviously, you know, pretty chuffed that he got up with us. And here we are today chatting about it. So, you know, it was a great memory and he's obviously a very nice man.
All right. So did you guys go see Springsteen after that? And did they invite you up on stage?
No, I didn't get to play that role out of that video.
Well, I don't know if you noticed, he's new album coming out in May, and then he's going to start touring with the Disciples of Soul. So he may be returning that favor yet when they head to Australia.
Well, I'd definitely say yes, but I don't know what I'd do, to be honest. He's so worshipped that, you know, people would probably just want to push me aside and just want, you know, listen to him. They don't want me to sort of interrupt.
Oh, no. Hey, Cracking Up is our coolest song in the world this week. It's the opening cut on your 2010 album, Purity of Essence, which abbreviates as POE, Peace on Earth, Purity of Essence.
That's right.
That's the code going on there. That's the code. So the lyrics, one of the verses there, people want to put their tag on you, define what you do, and you might enjoy some small renown, but it's hard to live down, stuck in a mold, do what you're told, a product of this bought and sold, mad out of straw, sentenced before the court of unwritten law.
Yeah.
Wow. So is that reflective of yourselves and the band?
God, yeah. You know, it's just about, you know, anything in life, but in particular, obviously, music. You know, people like to classify you and put you in, label you and put you away somewhere they can ignore you, you know. And you know, sometimes it's because you're successful, sometimes it's because you're not successful. Whatever the reason is, they just want to kind of, you know, marginalize you, really. And, you know, in our case, we certainly suffered from having too much success in our own market in Australia. You know, we kind of had pop hits and that wasn't cool at the time. You know, it was, you know, we had hits in the 80s and, you know, this was before there was any sort of, you know, crossover between, you know, independent music and the mainstream. And we kind of blazed a trail, but it was at the same time we alienated a lot of people who thought they were cooler than us and, you know, kind of were snobby about it, you know. And it wasn't – I kind of date it from when Nirvana had Smells Like Teen Spirit, where it's suddenly okay to have a hit and still be a cool band. But before that, people kind of really did kind of look down their nose at you. And, you know, it was too late for us. We'd already become uncool. But we're still here being uncool and doing what we like. You know, that's sort of what that song is about, that part.
Well, to me, being uncool and doing what you like, I mean, that is being cool, you know. And I completely know what you're talking about, because I was college radio DJ in that time. That's been, you know, first came across you guys with the Stone Age Romeo's album. But I do remember exactly what you're talking about. There was a great band from Boston, the Del Fuegos, and they appeared in a commercial, like a beer commercial, and it like destroyed their career after that.
Exactly. You know, I mean, they were
guys living out of a van, you know, and they needed any break they could get. But once that happened, the hipsters of the time, whatever they were called at that period of time, you know, just turned their back on the band, and it was terrible.
Yeah, I think REM got away with it, but they could have been into the same sort of thing. Their big success came sort of later in their career, yeah. Anyway. But you know, even early on, they sort of had some breakthroughs that got them onto pop radio. I think with Green, when was that album? That was Orange Crush. You know, Nirvana really was the thing that changed that whole perception, I believe. And you know, I thought that idea was stupid in the first place. You know, when the Hoodoo Gurus formed, you know, we all lived in this cool part of town, which is kind of like, you know, inner city part. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of fun and all that. But, you know, our second gig was actually in a regional area, in a country town, like, you know, big metropolitan, but it's in the country, you know, supporting a band. And that was our second gig, because we didn't want to just be ghettoized and to, you know, just only play to the converted. You know, we wanted to play to anyone that likes music. You know, we didn't care if they liked us and something that we didn't like and that made them uncool as an audience. We don't care. You know, if you like our songs, that's enough for us. You know, as long as you don't use our songs against us or to support some sort of philosophy we despise. But, you know, as far as loving music, what's wrong with liking us? You know, I don't see that as being sort of, you know, something that should be exclusive.
Well, speaking of your music, so this the album Purity of Essence, that came out in 2010, and I said, so are you planning on going to the studio anytime soon?
No, that's the eternal question I keep asking myself, and other people ask me. I'm very slow, you know, these days, because I don't know, it's sort of strange. We don't play like as often as we used to. We just kind of pick and choose, and you know, usually they're kind of festival shows, and a lot of those you don't get to play very long sets. So a new album would be hard to promote there. But you know, for our own peace of mind, I think we have to do something like that. So I am kind of, you know, sidling towards getting myself, you know, to commit to something, because I have to make myself a deadline. Otherwise, I'll just do nothing forever. That's just the way I am, unfortunately.
Okay, so Dave. I'll give you a deadline this year. Next time, let's have a new album.
You write that down and put it down in the calendar. I need it sooner. I need 6 months, I reckon.
Okay, well, I'll give you a whole year, but I'll stick you. I'll hold you hard and fast to it. You mentioned, you know, the Fleshtones, and they're
yes.
One of my all-time fave bands. And their frontman Peter's Run, the DJ here in the Underground Garage. I know you've also sat in with them on occasion over the years. You produced their Power Stance album. How did you meet those guys?
It was strange. As I say, I saw them perform in '79 when I was, you know, 21, and then when the Gurus formed, they toured over there in '84 for Stone Age Romeos. Someone from who was one of the people on the record label, one of the promotions people, knew that we liked them, and so they put the call out to the Fleshtones and said, you know, there's this band from Australia wants to see, you know, wants to meet you guys. And Keith and Gordon Spaeth came down to see us play at CBGB's. And and they got up and, you know, got up on stage with us that very first time we met. And then they did another gig with us somewhere else. You know, I think Keith and his then girlfriend went to see us on Long Island somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we became fast friends straight away. But I hadn't met them before that moment. But obviously I loved them and you know, was collecting their albums and, you know, being quite a fan already. But to meet them and become their friend was, you know, something I didn't expect. And it's been obviously an incredible thing for me right through my life now.
And so I know that one occasion I mentioned you sat in with them, but it seemed like you had flown over and you did a bunch of shows with them up in the Northeast. How often have you done that? Just a couple of times.
I've been to Spain. No, I didn't go. I've been to Italy with them. I'm trying to think where else. I would be. Usually, if I was on tour somewhere and there was a chance to catch up with them somewhere, I'd make it happen. But usually, it would be in the U.S. And you know, I've got lots of friends besides the Fleshtones that I visit. And as I say, we used to tour a lot as well. And I'd start the tour with a vacation and finish it with a vacation. So I'd, you know, get the most bang for my buck, because that's the hard part about living in Australia. You know, it's worse than living in Perth in some ways, because it's so expensive to go anywhere, and you know, and it's just difficult. So when you do get the hell out to somewhere else, you try to make the most of it. I played with them so much, you know. I was on the Love Delegation record way back when.
That's a great record. A lot of fun.
I've been on all sorts of things with them, and as I say, I've toured with them just as a fan, you know, watching them play. You know, I think the last time I saw them play was Halloween, maybe a few years ago when I was last in the US. So I can't be sure, you know. But as I say, anytime whenever I'm going anywhere, I always see if they're around nearby, because I'm going to try and catch up with them.
Well, I mentioned you produced the Power Stance album of theirs. Are you producing still other bands, or anybody you're working with now you'd like to plug?
I only produce the Gurus these days. I mean, usually co-produce. I produced a couple of our albums by myself. You know, it was credited to the band, but it was basically me. But I didn't enjoy producing other people, because, you know, you don't get to make the decisions all the time that you think is best for the music. They might disagree, and it wasn't the case with the Fleshtones, by the way. It's probably me that made the mistakes with them rather than them choosing to do things that I didn't agree with. But I just didn't like the thing of, like, you know, you do all this work, you're there 24 hours a day almost in the studio, and the band members can come and go as they're required. Right. And so you're doing all this work, and at the end of the day, it's not your album. It's theirs. You know? You've got to let go of it and kind of move on. You know, it's just a strange thing. You know, I didn't like that part of it, you know. So I'm prepared to sacrifice all that time and energy for my own music, but if someone else's, it's too hard. And also, you know, as I say, when it comes down to it, the decisions always have to be the artist's decisions, and, you know, I didn't like not being the artist either. You know, just being a facilitator of someone else's art was not really a role I liked.
Well, you know, back in 1984, I was a college radio DJ when that debut album, Stone Age Romeos, came out. And I just have to sing its praises one more time. What, you know, fun songs from Kamikaze Pilots to Human Sacrifice to Necrophilia that would make Jimmy Cross proud. It's all there. And I want to go out with a song, Let's All Turn On. And in that song, you like name check, you know, all these different song titles, exactly the type of stuff we play in the underground garage. What got you into rock and roll, Dave? I mean, you mentioned reading magazines when you were younger and stuff, but what got you playing music?
Well, my brother was 8 years older than I, and, you know, I was born in the late 50s, but, you know, obviously come up to consciousness really in the 60s, and he'd bring all the cool records home from, you know, because he had a job. He left school early, so he had his income quite young, and he'd bring home singles by the Stones and the, you know, Manfred Mann and the Animals or whatever, and, you know, Australia's, you know, the Easy Beats, things like that. Right. So that was all around me, and, you know, I was a huge Beatles nut as well. I used to go to sleep to With the Beatles. With the Beatles and Revolver are my two favourite Beatles albums, which I know Revolver's one you have, but With the Beatles you never actually had. Originally, it was all the songs were cut up and made different sorts of albums for the US market.
Right. But, Meet the Beatles, I guess, was the closest equivalent we had to.
Yeah. Well, With the Beatles, their second album was just one that I used to go to sleep to, and it's still my favourite era of the Beatles music, is that early Cavern sort of style, you know. I just love that sort of music. And then, you know, having that grounding in that 60s stuff, and then discovering 70s punk and backtracking from there when I got old enough to kind of, you know, to figure out the connections, you know, and get back to the Stooges and the Dolls and, you know, all those things, and the Velvets, of course. You know, it just, you never stop discovering the links and going further and deeper into music, and it's just a life's work, really. And I'm still digging stuff that I haven't got to before, that you know, just discovering. So,
well, can you tell me anything that you've discovered recently, or sort of like, oh my god, I didn't realize this? Or,
well, gee, I'm trying to think. Well, not very recently. It's just weird things. Like, for example, you know, not this last 6 months or something. In the last few years, I mean, I've really, really come to love Roxy music. You know, I heard them way back when, and you know, I thought they were okay, but I didn't kind of get it. And now I'm just, I just think, you know, Brian Ferry is a brilliant lyricist, and, you know, I love their albums. I think they're incredible. So things like that, you know, it's just something in plain sight I should have known already, but I didn't, you know, because I never really kind of paid attention properly to it. So that's one, you know, things like that.
Well, right. Well, you know, here in the States, people that, you know, from your generation, so you were born, you said, was it 57 or 59?
What 57,
you?
Yeah.
This would have been applicable to you if you were here in the States. You know, the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so when I speak to people that, you know, came of age in that decade, that's always the go-to thing. The typical thing that's said is, oh, you know, I loved Elvis, but when I saw the Beatles, that on Ed Sullivan, that changed my life. That was this pivotal moment. I decided, you know, I'm going to be in a band. I'm going to play music. Was there anything like that in Australia, watershed moment for a generation or not?
Well, there's lots of them. We had our own, you know, music scene, obviously, as you know, from the Easy Beats and people like that. But also earlier, we had a guy called Johnny O'Keefe. Right. He had a show called 6 o'clock Rock. I know the Fleshtones have played a Johnny O'Keefe song. But we had our own sort of music scene, and you know, they were personalities on television, and they had, you know, as I said, it was a TV show every week called 6 o'clock Rock. So that was something I remember growing up. But you know, for example, you mentioned the Beatles. They were already a success in Australia for a year before they made it in America. You know, they toured Australia before in 1963. So you know, we had them straight away, pretty much. Their first single was a hit here. You know, we had that at home. You know, so you know, just. That stuff was really in the air, and you know, especially in the case of the Beatles, in my case, you know, for me, I used to, you know, wait and see what the next Beatles album would be. It was such a, you know, revolutionary thing always, usually at the time. You know, the Beatles have gone, you know, they've gone to India and they've brought back, you know, sitars or something. You know, that was a revelation. I mean, of course, nowadays you think, well, it's not that big a deal, but at the time it was something we hadn't heard in music before, and every album they seemed to be going somewhere else, and right. And so was the music around them. So just that feeling back then of just being on the cusp of something new at every week, you know, something new could happen. That was an amazing feeling. I don't feel that way anymore, but obviously I still find music that excites me just as much as that. It's just not something from a brand new band every week, you know. It's stuff that I might not have discovered from the 40s or 50s, you know, just things that you just think back through that is in its own way still revolutionary when you hear it.
Right. Well, now you're at the point in your life, too, where it's more like instead of, you know, throwing down a 12-pack, you can sit back with a bottle of wine.
To me, rock and roll has become a bit like jazz, where, you know, there's still brilliant jazz musicians and making incredible records, but you're not going to discover a new sort of jazz anymore, you know. So I think pop has gone through all these different sort of, you know, blending other influences and you know, coming of age, and this, you know, in some ways I still prefer the innocent pop, as I was trying to say before about the Beatles. You know, that early phase of the Beatles is my favorite, rather than the more mature Beatles that everyone else worships, you know. I mean, I love that stuff, but to me the energy and the primitive sort of side of the Beatles are much better, and I look for that in a lot of music, and you know, there's not much people can do that's going to surprise you anymore, but the only thing that they can do is just play damn well and play songs you want to hear about things that, you know, matter. I mean, there's always a room for a new song, but we aren't going to discover a new genre, I don't think, anymore. I think the last time we did that was the 80s with, you know, that kind of British electro pop thing, kind of, you know, was a new kind of mutation of that sort of old, you know, Kraftwerk and all that sort of stuff. And then, of course, hip-hop, you know, that was the last great movement in music. And it's a bit, you know, there's a lot of art forms like that, you know. The detective story is probably the last great genre of, you know, creative writing. So, you know, there's just only so far you can go before you actually are just basically repeating similar kind of themes that, but it's the way you do it that makes it exciting.
Well, I agree with you 100% on that. In fact, I like the jazz analogy as well. I think it's very true. Dave, we're going to have to wrap things up. I need to thank you so much for being my guest today on our Coolest Conversations.
Cool.
Let's hitch a ride now on the Wayback Machine back to the Stone Age, the time of Stone Age Romeos. Here's Let's All Turn On from the Hoodoo Gurus and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Shake some action, psychotic reaction, no satisfaction, sky sex, and that's what I like. That's what I like. It's great bar to the jailhouse run. Stop at the heart to the Gucci bar. That's what I like. That's what I like. That's what I like. Better give my clout to the crowd. Better give.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.